From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Tomorrow, South Carolina's voters go to the polls for the Democratic primary. African Americans are expected to be nearly half of those voters. And today we bring you our last live show from South Carolina. We also give you a double dose of presidential politics. Yesterday we heard from Senator Barack Obama. Today we bring you the two other top candidates in the race for the Democratic nomination. Shortly, we'll hear from Senator John Edwards, a South Carolina native. But first, Senator Hillary Clinton, who we spoke with earlier today. Hi, Senator. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. So your two major competitors in this race have come to symbolize certain things. Senator Edwards paints himself as the candidate who's going to end poverty, and Senator Obama's supporters say he's the candidate of change. So what do you symbolize?
Well, I think that I'm the candidate with the experience we need to make the changes we want. I don't think there is an either-or here. That's a false choice. We have to look at each of us and what we represent and what we have done in our lives and what we believe we can do as the next president. So I have a record of taking on tough issues, of fighting against the special interests, of standing up against the health insurance companies and the drug companies and the oil companies and all the rest of it. But I've also produced positive change.
During your husband's term in office, you championed a comprehensive health care plan, and Republicans quickly shot it down. So a lot of analysts said the problem wasn't the plan itself, but that you didn't get bipartisan support. Now, when you were a first-term senator, you made a point of joining an all-Republican prayer group. Are you careful to be bipartisan because of what you learned from the healthcare debate?
Well, first of all, it is a bipartisan prayer group. It's very important for me to set the record straight on that because it's something that is extremely important to a number of senators. It's a time when people can get behind closed doors and, you know, talk openly and pray together. And I have been there sometimes, and it's a real blessing. But I think that it's important to recognize that in our system, bipartisanship is essential, particularly in the Senate, to get anything done. And I think it's important, too, to recognize that that's exactly what I've done over the last 7 years and even before that, because I really believe that we have to look for solutions. These are not Democratic or Republican solutions. These are the kinds of American solutions that I think our people are really hungering for. And I have joined together with some unlikely allies. You know, here in South Carolina, I joined up with Senator Lindsey Graham to provide access to health care for the National Guard and Reserve members. And now more than 9,000 members right here in South Carolina are eligible for something they didn't have before we put together a bipartisan piece of legislation and pushed it through over a threat of a veto from President Bush.
Now, at various times during this campaign, you've been criticized for being too tough, or in the case when you got choked up in New Hampshire, for being too sensitive. How do you actually navigate the different expectations that people have of a woman leader?
That is such a great question, Farai, because that's what I'm doing, and I'm doing it out here in public, kind of on a high wire, trying to strike the right balance. You know, I can only be myself, and you know, I am a serious person, and I think these are serious times and deserve serious leadership, but I'm also, I hate to admit it, a human being with all of the feelings and experiences and you know, real, you know, hopes and dreams for myself and my family and my country that I think every one of us have. And I have really been just doing the best I can in this very long, intense campaign to talk about what I want to do as president, because ultimately this election isn't about me. It's not about any of the candidates. It's about, you know, what we're going to do for your listeners, what we're going to do to help people. You know, I'm going to Benedict College later this morning to talk about making college affordable. This is a huge problem around the country, and it's especially tough here in South Carolina. So, you know, I'm going to stay focused on what the job is and how I can do the job, but I do understand why people want to, you know more about me as a person. They may not know that 35 years ago I went to work for a South Carolina native, Marion Wright Edelman, at the Children's Defense Fund, and have been, you know, focused on improving the lives of our children ever since.
We actually spoke with actress Victoria Rowell. She's written a best-selling book about growing up in the foster care system. She's stumping
Isn't she
for
wonderful?
You. Absolutely. And, you know, she talked about your commitment, not just with Marion Wright Edelman, but providing free legal services in child abuse cases when you were getting your law degree at Yale. Why is this kind of work so important to you?
I think that it initially was important because my mother had such a very difficult life. And, you know, if she had been born in a later time, I believe that she probably would have been put into the foster care system because her parents essentially abandoned her, and her grandparents were very unwelcoming, and basically she had to leave their home when she was 13 to go to work in someone else's home just to be able to have a safe place to live and to try to, you know, be able to make some way of in her life. They let her take care of their children, but she had to get up and get the other children off to school, and they let her go to high school. So, you know, I really saw at a very early age that despite my comfortable, secure upbringing in my family, that wasn't the case for so many children. And it just became the cause of my passionate commitment here in public service to do what I can to give every child the chance to live up to his or her God-given potential.
We spoke to Senator Obama yesterday, asked him if he thought the remarks by your husband, President Clinton, were really about race, and Senator Obama said no. So why do you think so many people, including some of our listeners, saw race in those comments?
I don't know, but I obviously deeply regret that because that's not at all the case, and I think that you know, both Senator Obama and I have made that clear. We have tried to make this race about two individuals. It's wonderful and it's celebratory that you know, one is African American and one is a woman. That's a great tribute to the Democratic Party and to our country. But we know we're running as individuals. You know, we want this race to be about us, what we represent, what we plan for the future, our plans for the economy and for health care and for college affordability and all of the other issues that people talk to me about. So we have both said repeatedly that, you know, this is not about race and it's not about gender. Obviously, we know we represent that in many people's minds, but at the end of the day, we want voters to choose who they believe will be the best president.
Well, Senator, we certainly hope that you will join us again on News and Notes.
I would very much enjoy that. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Senator Hillary Clinton is one of the front runners in the Democratic race for the White House. She joined us by phone while campaigning in South Carolina. And now to get a wider lens on the state of the race for Democrats and Republicans, I'm joined by Sherrilyn Ifill. She's a civil rights lawyer, and she also teaches at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore. We've also got Ron Walters. He's the director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. Good to have you on, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So we just heard from Senator Clinton, and she talked about wanting people to understand that she's a human being. That's her words. Does it seem like she's letting voters in more, Sherrilyn, by giving more personal information, more anecdotes about her life?
Well, I don't think so. I think these are the anecdotes that we've heard Mrs. Clinton give before. I mean, her work with the Children's Defense Fund and so forth. I think that we know about that background. And in fact, we knew about that background when Bill Clinton was president. And I think it's her more recent record that is really on the table, I think, for Democrats as they choose between primary candidates. You know, it's her various positions on the Iraq War, for example, that's so important. And so I think, you know, in some ways, it's supposed to create a more human picture, but it's really on recycled old information. We don't know a lot about the thinking of Hillary Clinton and about her personal struggles since her husband was in the White House. She's been very careful actually never to be revealing about any of that. So, you know, I don't find this to be kind of new, and I don't find it to be fresh. I do think she has decided that this is an effective way to influence voters after the incident in New Hampshire and her win in New Hampshire. So I do think that she realizes that voters want to see a more human quality, but I'm not sure she's giving us that much to go on, certainly not any new information that helps us understand or even be able to really trust that Mrs. Clinton will be able to resist her impulses to, you know, really try to out Republican Republicans on a variety of issues.
Let me get Ron in here. So, in general, how important is emotion to voters, including African American voters, the idea that you have a texture that is resonating?
Well, culture itself is really very important to all voters, and because it is the way in which they establish trust with candidates, and therefore if they can establish trust, then they can give people their political support. So that in this case, I think that what you did, Farai, was to make, I think, a safe place for her, if she wanted to open up and to talk about things that would give us a far more intimate look at who she is. When you asked a direct question, how she negotiated these various roles, well, this is what someone asked her in New Hampshire, and I think really what was led to that emotional moment, and I fully expected that she would do something of the same thing here, except she didn't. She was very descriptive in her remarks, and therefore didn't give us the kind of inside look that we're all, I think, would like from this woman.
Well, I want you guys to stay with us. We're going to take a break and pick up our discussion after we hear from former senator and presidential candidate John Edwards. We are speaking to civil rights lawyer and professor Sherrilyn Ifill and Ron Walters of the University of Maryland. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Tomorrow's Democratic presidential primary here in South Carolina is a crucial one for Senator John Edwards. It's the state where he was born. Edwards' message here has been especially geared towards poor and working-class South Carolinians, and he might be resonating more with African Americans in the state if he were not competing against an African American candidate, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton, a woman with strong ties to Black America. I spoke with Edwards and asked what he plans to do after tomorrow if he doesn't win at least second place.
Oh, I'm in this for the long haul. And the causes that I'm engaged in, speaking for people who don't have a voice, speaking for the uninsured, for people who live in poverty, for our veterans, for men and women who are serving in Iraq, that's the cause. Those are the causes of my life, and they're not going away. And I'm in this for the long haul.
Now, you've talked many times, including in this week's debate, about your father working in the mills. You yourself have succeeded in making millions of dollars, living a much wealthier lifestyle. So when people think about their place in America, what obligation do voters in your income bracket have to pay their taxes and take action on behalf of poor and working class people?
They have an obligation to do what I've done my whole life. I came from a family that had nothing. I worked hard all my life. In fact, the way I made my living was representing the kind of people that I grew up with, people who didn't have much of anything, fighting against very entrenched, powerful corporate interests. And we were able to win and be successful. I did well by doing good. And what we have a responsibility to do is make sure we don't pull the ladder up behind us, that everybody gets. In fact, the core reason I'm running for president is to make sure that everybody in this country gets the kind of chances and opportunities that I've had in my life. That's what drives me every single day.
A lot of your supporters mention that you really have a commitment to ending poverty, but could there ever be an America with absolutely no poverty? What would that country even look like?
It would be a country where everybody has real economic opportunity. I mean, is there always going to be a circumstance where somebody could fall into poverty? Of course. I mean, that's the real world. So if we do the things we need to do, we wouldn't have the kind of systematic endemic poverty we have in America. I mean, we have 37 million people, which is roughly the population of California, who live in poverty every day in this country. It's not a small number. And we are the most richest, most prosperous nation on the planet, and there are lots of things that we need to do. We need to raise the minimum wage. We need universal health care, make it easier for kids to go to college. We need to strengthen our out-of-unions to organize. Expand the earned income tax credit. I mean, there's a whole group of things that need to be done to address poverty in a really serious way.
We had on Sean Griffin. He's a sophomore at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. He's a black man, and he admitted, despite the fact that he's out there for you 110%, that sometimes people give him flack for being a black man who supports a white male candidate in a race with a black man and a white woman. So do you worry that some of the people who might otherwise support your message are taking race and gender into account in a way that doesn't favor you?
No, what I worry is that whether I'm being heard. I think Martin Luther King III just put out a statement a couple of days ago saying that the things that I've been driving in this entire campaign and in my life, you and I have spoken about already, but the problem we have is being heard through the glitz and glamour of Senator Obama and Senator Clinton's campaign and the money. They both have over $100 million of campaign money. That's the struggle that we have. When I get heard, it works. And it works every single time.
Are you running out of money?
No, we actually, here's the amazing thing that's happened. In the last, since the 1st of January, we've raised record amounts online, on the Internet. And as a result, the money won't be the issue. We have plenty of money.
Now, you mentioned the glitz and glamour of the Clinton and Obama campaigns. You have your own celebrity supporters like Danny Glover. Senator Obama brought out Chris Tucker and Kerry Washington, and there have been a lot of celebrities in the state. Danny Glover's out here for you. How important is celebrity? Should it be important?
Nobody should decide who to vote on based on who a celebrity is for. And I don't think this is news to anybody. Your listeners think exactly the same thing. They're not going to decide to vote for somebody because they have a celebrity supporting them. They're going to decide to vote for them because they believe they'd be the best president.
Do you ever feel pressure to get into the mix and sling some harder punches in a time where Senators Clinton and Obama seem to be going at each other and getting headlines for it? Do you ever think, I got to put some muscle into this and maybe I need to go after both of them?
Oh, no. I got plenty of muscle in this. My muscle is different than what you see from the two of them. What we saw in the debate at Myrtle Beach on CNN on Monday night was a lot of petty bickering and personal infighting between the two of them. And, you know, I was glad to be able to be the grown-up on the stage because this is not about any of us personally. And all that bickering is not going to get a single child health care. It's not going to lift a single American out of poverty. It's not going to create a single job. And it's, as long as we're talking about the differences that we have on issues, and we have differences on issues, you know, on health care, exactly what we do to end the war, how do we create jobs and end global poverty, attack global warming. I mean, we have differences on these substantive issues, but when it gets to the level of petty bickering and personal attacks, this is not helping anybody. And that's my view about it, and I have no intention of engaging in it.
You know, we're here in the South. You're a native Southerner. This part of the country is a place where history has been written and rewritten depending on who you consider the victor. And right now there's this tussle over Ben Tillman, Pitchfork Ben, South Carolina governor and U.S. senator in the late 19th century who supported lynching. How do you think, there's a question of whether or not to take down a statue of him, but how do you think Southern history, including the history of race relations, should be featured, focused on, talked about by people like yourself who have power?
Well, I can tell you my own perspective. I grew up in the South, South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina in the 50s and 60s. I saw the segregated South during my youth, and I saw the South transition during the Civil Rights Movement. This, I take it as a huge personal cause to continue the march to equality in this country. And I think having lived through it and not having seen it on television or read about it in a book, but having actually lived through the loss of lives, the extraordinary sacrifice of men and women who literally put their lives on the line to move this country toward civil rights and toward equality, I feel like I carry a huge responsibility and a huge burden. I said this in the debate, and I believe it. You know, we can put our head against the wall and pretend that history doesn't exist, but the reality is we had decades of slavery followed by decades of segregation followed by decades of discrimination, and some of that discrimination still continues today. And I think people like me who have lived through a lot of this carry an enormous responsibility to continue the march toward equality in this country.
Senator Edwards, thank you so much for talking to us.
Wonderful to be with you.
Senator John Edwards is making his second run for the White House. He joined us by phone while on the road somewhere between Anderson and Seneca, South Carolina. We're talking presidential politics, and we're back with Sherrilyn Ifill. She's a civil rights lawyer, and she teaches at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore. Plus, Ron Walters, he is the director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. So, guys, you heard my conversation with John Edwards, and he said that he wonders if his message is being heard above the louder political brawling between the Obama and Clinton camps. Ron, is the former senator's message being heard?
It's very difficult for it to be heard because I think one of the motivations that got him into this race was that he came in second last time and that he had the prospect of doing better. What he didn't reckon on, I think, sufficiently was that these two people would create the kind of dynamic that they created. Barack Obama, on the one hand, a fairly genuine political movement of a sort with lots of dynamism in it. And, of course, Hillary Clinton, the patina of the first female president of the United States, bringing along her husband and a show of its own. So I think that his message is having difficulty getting through. A message devoted to the kinds of things that African Americans and other poor people feel very strongly about. This is a section of the American electorate that's always had difficulty, but in these circumstances, it's going to have greater difficulty.
Sherrilyn, a current poll from the Associated Press says that Edwards is picking up white voters. His support in South Carolina among whites has grown, according to them, from 28% to 40%. He and I talked about the South, the Old South and the New South. Do you think that Southerners are ready to vote for a black man?
I think it's a really important question, one not to be glossed over. I tend to be fairly cynical in this regard, and I don't think it's just the South. I think we saw some of that in New Hampshire, where Obama's poll numbers were quite different than what the actual election results, at least until we have the recount, showed. And so it doesn't surprise me that Edwards' numbers would increase, because I think some white voters are turned off by Hillary Clinton and they're looking for an option. The problem with black voters in Edwards is that he's run up against what is a very strong pragmatic streak in the black community, and that is that we want to vote for somebody who can actually be elected. And the more Edwards is seen as being third or an also-ran, the less black voters, even if his message is the message that in all other circumstances they would like to hear, will not vote for him, because we've got that pragmatic streak and we want to do what we think is the possible, not the impossible.
Sherrilyn, let me stick with you for a second. You recently blogged about the spat between Bill Clinton and the Obama camp. You titled it Play a Hatin' Part 2, Bill versus Barack. What do you mean?
Well, because I think that there is, if you look at Clinton's President Clinton's response to Barack Obama and his kind of tour that he's doing and really taking up being the attack dog in the campaign, it's really disturbing. And you do have to kind of look at what's the reason for the almost red-faced, finger-waving anger that he seems to have demonstrated, this idea that somehow Barack Obama's getting a free ride. And I think that there's this sense in which, we ironically talk about Clinton being the first black president, or at least Toni Morrison did. There's no question that he has had a very special relationship with the African-American community. And I think that he feels threatened. I think he feels that he has a right to, particularly in South Carolina, call in his markers with the black community. And so I do call it player hating because, Barack Obama holds the possibility of becoming the real first black president.
And, let me go to Ron with this question. The first black president, let me bring in yet another factor. There have been people like Harold Ford who folks thought might run for president. Black America has been waiting a long time for what's called a viable candidate. What does it do to the dynamics of black-white relations, if anything?
I think very little, primarily because when you look at this year alone, everything from Katrina to Gen 6 to nooses, lynches, all sorts of things happening of a racial nature with a very strong mobilization following, demonstrations and so forth. It's very clear to me that the election of a black president is going to have very little to do with actually dealing with those kinds of things. As a matter of fact, Barack Obama, the only way that he's going to get elected really to do what his campaign is doing, and that is to try to neutralize race. And we're talking about Bill Clinton insofar as they try to blacken Barack Obama. What they do is to play on the divisiveness of the racial factor. And
so, Ron, let me get this right. You don't think that Senator Obama is electable?
No, I didn't say that. I said that his campaign is trying to devalue race. They're trying to neutralize it in order to get him elected, in order to make him more electable. The objective of the Clinton campaign is to make him blacker, which is to say to call out his blackness and therefore to complicate his constituency, which is predominantly white.
Ron, let me stick with you and talk about the Republicans. They're campaigning in Florida. There's a GOP primary in 4 days, and they had a debate last night. What stood out to you?
What stood out to me was the frantic effort of Rudolph Giuliani really to stay in the race. And I just thought that Mitt Romney, of course, was very confident in terms of his position in Florida. And I think that what we see in Giuliani really is a failing campaign. I think their response is having to do with the stimulus package and elevating the war in Iraq to a prominent position in the Republican pantheon, really non-starters with most of the American people, and therefore I was very much surprised about that. But Mitt Romney was the only one who came back to say, yes, this is important, but right now the economy is important, and I'm the guy that can fix it.
Sherilyn, what do you think about John McCain, for example? The way he was talked about in the Democratic debate in South Carolina was, hey, he's the man to beat. They've also, on the Republican side, talked about Hillary Clinton as the person to beat. Is there a presumption on both sides that certain people are the people who will get the nomination?
Oh, definitely. I think so. And I think those are the two who are presumed. I certainly don't think Mitt Romney can be counted out, given that he has a virtually unlimited source of private money to continue campaigning. And who knows what Huckabee might be able to do, although he's looking increasingly as though he's not being as much of a contender. But I think that Ron is absolutely right. It was pretty remarkable last night at the debate to hear, you know, Tim Russert say, you know, 6 out of 10 Americans say Iraq is a mistake and we ought to get out, you know, what, and it's not worth it. What's your response? And every single one of the Republican candidates said, you know, I disagree. So there is this sense, and in previous debates we've seen it too, the refusal to distance themselves from the Bush policy in Iraq, despite the fact that a majority of the country sees that as the wrong policy and that Bush has incredibly low approval ratings. So they're making a calculation that I think is a dangerous one and that they may have to deal with after we get past the primaries and we get to the general election season.
Ron, we only have a little bit of time, but if you talked about McCain versus Clinton or McCain versus Obama, what would be the difference between those two races, you think?
Well, I think that McCain would probably stay where he is in terms of his elevating, of course, the war and the fight against terrorism. I think he would make a pretty good target for somebody like Barack Obama who wants change. Barack Obama is in this race doing as well as he is because he has the best record on the opposition to the war in Iraq. So I think that would be probably the most heated one. I have trouble with the fact that Hillary Clinton, of course, who has been more moderate on the war, would be a stark opposition to a John McCain. Well, I think that the most fun we would have would be between Barack Obama and McCain.
All right. Well, on that note, Ron and Sherilyn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sherilyn Ifill is a civil rights lawyer. She's also a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore. And Ron Walters is the director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We've got our weekly Reporters Roundtable, and we're hitting politics and more with Ron Claiborne, a correspondent for ABC News, and Leroy Chapman, Jr. He's the government and politics editor for the state newspaper here in South Carolina. Welcome, guys.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
So, Leroy, you're sitting with me in the studio right now, and we've descended out-of-town media on your city and state. How do you, who have been covering South Carolina from inside, relate to us? I mean, and what happens, you know, when folks descend on a city and a state?
Well, I think a lot of our history tends to come back because when people think of South Carolina, they think of many things. Race certainly is a factor, and it's a factor in our coverage, too, because, you know, we live in a very diverse state. If you look at this primary compared to the other primaries, I think the racial diversity here is pretty stark and evident. So I think the national media, though, they come, and there are a couple of stories that I think sometimes South Carolinians wince when they see. One of them probably is the Confederate flag, because that's one I think that our the folks who live here sometimes, I think, tire of. So when the national media comes, it inevitably comes up.
Now, Ron, you have been following John McCain, and as you follow him around, how does he seem to interact with the local politics of the places he goes?
Well, certainly, as Leroy can tell you, in South Carolina, he came armed with endorsements this time in 2000, where he was, well, it's widely accepted that he was smeared. He was the victim of a smear campaign, which may have cost him that state 8 years ago. This time, he had the foresight and the strategy to line up a lot of endorsements from presumably influential state politicians, Senator Lindsey Graham, Bobby Harrell, the Speaker of the legislature there, and Attorney General Henry McMaster were with his constant companions in South Carolina. So he had the, I think, the foresight and learned the lesson of 2000 and came armed this time and narrowly won over Huckabee, as we saw.
Now, here at News and Notes, we talk a lot about walking the line between serving our target African-American audience, and you know black folks are overwhelmingly Democrats, and providing balanced coverage of the political playing field. So, Ron, how do you think journalists should cover the issue? It's something that, you know, it's a tough decision.
Well, are you talking about the Republican campaign?
Well, yeah, the balance. I mean, when you are looking at really dealing with a primarily African-American audience, there has not been a lot of love, a lot of participation from the Republican side in African-American forums and debates. How do you deal with that and still try to bring up the issues as you report from a very objective standpoint?
Well, look, the reality is the Republican races thus far and for the foreseeable future are involve white voters. I think in South Carolina, 97% of the Republican vote was white. There was an attempt to have a debate with the Republican candidates in Baltimore that Tavis Smiley was trying to organize in PBS. Virtually none of the front runners in the Republican field bothered to show up. In private conversations, I've spoken to John McCain about the future of the Republican Party if it remains a white party. Now, he said, he claimed that, the reason most of the people who show up at his rallies and his events, not just his, but Romney's and Giuliani's, in the early going states were white was because these states were overwhelmingly white. Well, that's factually accurate, but it's also, I guess, a bit misleading because the implication is that in a more heavily African-American state that his audiences, the Republican candidates' audiences, would reflect the composition of those states. And that's, I think we all know that's simply not the case. And when I talked to McCain privately about this, he says that the Republican Party cannot prosper and exist in the future if it remains an all-white party. But if you look at the issues and the rhetoric and the language that the Republican candidates are using in 2008, it's clear that there's no obvious effort to attract the votes of African Americans, and certainly the stance of many of these candidates on the immigration issue has pushed the Latinos away from the party, where they had made inroads in recent years.
Let me get Leroy in here. This is not a state without black voters. You have plenty of black folks in South Carolina. So was there any love when the Republicans came to town in terms of visiting African-American communities, trying to get out the vote, sway some independent voters who were black to the Republican side?
One candidate visited what we would call in South Carolina the Black Belt. We have a band of majority black counties in South Carolina. John McCain did that. He went and he visited South Carolina State University. In that visit, there was a little bit of an exchange there, but it was extraordinary. He wrote a story about it. He went there, but I guess the theme was military. South Carolina State has an ROTC unit that is renowned in the country, and they also boast about the fact that they produce more black generals than any other institution in the country at South Carolina State. They're pretty proud of that. And he came and he did talk. He did talk to students. But he's the only one. The rest of the Republicans spent most of their time in the upstate of South Carolina, which is very white. That's where I was born and raised. So they were there. They were on the coast where there are a lot of white voters and a lot of money.
Let's move on to an issue that's been raising a lot of static. A Long Island newspaper called The Independent recently published an op-ed by one, and I'm quoting here, "Yo Mama, Ben Barack." The Democratic presidential candidates have sparred in code about race, but this article said, quote, and this is obviously written under a pseudonym, "My wife, Ali Bama, said, why don't you cut out the president expletive and get a real job and make some real frickin' money. But I explained I have plenty of money because bleeding heart Democrats from all across this vast country have felt it in their hearts to send a contribution." Now, the publisher has apologized for our lapse of judgment, taken the op-ed off of the paper's website, but the debate isn't over. What I want to ask you, Leroy, is that there's racial code and then there's a straight-on attack. Do you expect, as this campaign continues, that there will be more issues that really spark things straight on?
Sure. If you look at South Carolina, and I don't know if this is a prelude to what's going to happen, but race was certainly an issue here. And there are some political watchers who think that some of it was deliberate. I know that's been discussed about whether or not making Barack Obama a blacker candidate makes him a less electable candidate. But this is the first state where there were African Americans. When we go into February 5th on Tsunami Tuesday, as it's been dubbed, there will be other states where there will be black populations, and certainly those issues are going to be raised from the grassroots as they were here. So certainly I expect that to happen. Here in South Carolina, sure, there's always murmurs of people who wonder about a black candidate who is electable. They question our media coverage, wondering if it's tough enough. Even the president wondered if it's tough enough if he's getting a pass in the media because he's African-American, if we're in love with the story of having an electable, seemingly African-American candidate.
Now, Ron, when you have been on the campaign trail, and I'm not speaking so much about Senator McCain here, although if you've heard something, let us know. But how do people at rallies and so on talk about the prospect of going head to head with a potential black Democratic nominee? Do they even talk about it?
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing, and maybe this is just New Hampshire, but I would talk to people in this case, the McCain, at their events, at their rallies, and when you ask them, had they made up their minds for who they were going to vote for, they would say, it's between McCain and Barack Obama. Now, that is astounding, if you think about it. I mean, one is obviously a very liberal Democrat, and the other is a conservative Republican. I think the results in New Hampshire show that if these independent voters, which is what they were, ended up casting the ballot, they tended to go for McCain. But in New Hampshire, at least, you saw people entertaining the idea of Barack Obama or John McCain. And I think the appeal to them, when ideologically they seem so different, is that McCain is perceived as outside the mainstream insofar as he will speak frankly and openly and take unpopular positions. And Barack Obama is clearly the fresh face. So on the face of it, these two have very little in common, and yet they seem to have be appealing in some cases to many of the same voters.
Leroy, is it a wrap for black folks? And what I mean is black folks have been flavor of the week, of the month here in South Carolina, folks bringing attention to the black vote. Is it all going to disappear after your primary?
I think so. In terms of the presidential election, after tomorrow, I think South Carolina is really not in play at all. Obviously, the state trends Republican, and it will continue to look at who shows up.
What about the whole idea of talking about black issues? Is that going to diminish after this black primary?
Maybe so. I mean, we've got some one of the things about South Carolina being diverse, there is diverse leadership here. But one of the things I think is Democrats, especially as a party, one wonders if there is going to be a bit of a rift that continues after this. There were obviously black political leaders lined up on both sides of this, of either Clinton, Obama, some Edwards. And there are people who wonder out loud whether or not there's going to be a rift there that continues after the candidates leave, after the signs are trash, and after they've gone on to other states. So I think that is an issue.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to have to let you go, but we appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Leroy Chapman, the government and politics editor for the state newspaper. He joined me here in the studios of South Carolina Educational TV, plus Ron Claiborne. He's a correspondent for ABC News, and he joined us from ABC Radio in New York City. As we approach the South Carolina Democratic primary tomorrow, we're taking a look at the power of celebrity. This has been the most diverse presidential race in American history. The two top contenders nationwide on the Democratic side, a black man, Barack Obama, and a white woman, Hillary Clinton. Add John Edwards into the mix and you'll see plenty of celebrities doing their part to elevate the profiles of the top three Democratic candidates. Many of those celebrities are black. This week we've seen an unprecedented number of African-American stars speaking out for their candidate of choice. Among them, actors Kerry Washington and Chris Tucker. They tag-teamed at rallies here in South Carolina for Barack Obama. Victoria Rowell has talked about her support of Hillary Clinton, and Danny Glover has hit the campaign trail for John Edwards. But how important is celebrity on the campaign trail, and can it sway voters?
They're not going to decide to vote for somebody because they have a celebrity supporting them. They're going to decide to vote for him because they believe they'd be the best president.
That was presidential hopeful John Edwards. He said that earlier in the show. But if nobody paid attention to celebrities, they probably wouldn't be coming in droves to South Carolina. Actor and director Danny Glover is on the move this week, campaigning for Edwards here in South Carolina. He told us that black artists and entertainers mixing it up with politics is hardly new.
I'm a child of the civil rights movement. I understand clearly how that the movement itself transformed this country, how people became mobilized. Artists such as Harry Belafonte, Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee, Sidney Poitier and other actors had a voice in that particular point in time, were involved in those movements, and subsequently involved in the respective candidates.
The actress Kerry Washington stumped at the historically black Benedict College for Senator Barack Obama. She also said that history motivates her to get involved.
So many women died and gave their lives for the suffragette movement, and then so many people of color fought and lost their lives for, you know, full citizenship for African Americans. And then even as young people, it's like, it's not until relatively recently that we brought the voting age down to 18. It used to be that, you know, the government could ship you off to war, but you couldn't vote for president. So it's like, we have all these rights that we've really fought for. We have to appreciate them and exercise these rights.
For some celebrities, political choices come straight from personal experience. Actress and author Victoria Rowell grew up in the foster care system. It was this experience that led her to become a longtime supporter of Hillary Clinton.
I supported Hillary Clinton long before she became a presidential candidate or announced because of her 30 years of committed experience to many times the disenfranchised, foster children and children waiting for adoption.
We asked her whether her race or her gender was something she took into account when picking her candidate.
I've never been swayed by race or gender. I care about who I think is going to care about the interests and the issues that our country is desperate for, and I think Hillary Clinton is that presidential candidate.
Danny Glover also says his choice of candidate has a lot to do with how he grew up.
Who I am in my family is simply an aberration. My brothers, my sisters, my niece, the nephew have to worry about the education of their children. They have to worry about health care. They have to worry about shelter and living wage and pensions and all those things that are important to all working people. So if I find a candidate who focuses on that and is concerned about that, then I think it's our responsibility to support those candidates.
Glover feels privileged that people will listen to what he has to say. And he says folks in the limelight have as much of a right to speak out as anyone else.
If I'm talking about the issue of education, are we denied the access to that conversation because we're celebrities? Or should we not talk to people if we have a particular view on that or support a certain philosophy, an idea around that? I don't think so. You know, I would think that it is even more our responsibility as celebrities to be engaged in what is happening and encourage people to become involved actively in a democracy.
Whatever happens in South Carolina tomorrow, it's clear that celebrities will continue to have their say, and Americans, at least some of us, will listen.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.